We like to think that we today are much like our ancestors of old. I'm afraid to say we're not. As I've said numerous times before in this podcast, we today have much more in common with foreigners living in seemingly alien cultures on the other side of the world from us than the previous residents of our nation. If you go back far enough, the people who walk the same streets as we do today are often more alien, more strange, more unrecognizable to us than we care to admit. They didn't just speak a different language, they thought differently to us. In 1247, there was an event in London that perfectly sums this up. While in explaining it, I will use terms and language to describe this event to you framed in modern concepts, the hardest task will be to try and translate the sheer foreign nature of this event in a way that you can understand it. Because make no mistake, this is an alien event. It was an attempt by the King of England to try and make Westminster the holiest place in England, to celebrate his faith in a way that was both ecstatic and political, in a manner we have issues trying to conceptualize. It was a result of a way of seeing faith, domestic policy, foreign relations, ritual, the way you dress, and more as a singular concept, all united in a specific idea. This was the moment where, in effect, Jesus himself, the Christ, the risen Messiah of the Christian faith, manifested his glory and august presence upon Westminster. At least, according to the king, he did. Hi, my name is Saul, and this is the story of London, an antiquarian's single-minded desire to try and tell the history of the city in regular weekly updates. It takes a chronological approach to the city's history, which means it can get bogged down in small cul-de-sacs of history at times, like the current episodes, where we're mired in the long, very long history of the reign of Henry III. But we have stumbled across a crucial year in the king's reign, one that is both an exploration of his life so far and sows the seeds for future issues that will arise during his rule. Welcome then to chapter 92 of the story of London. Jesus comes to Westminster. Our story starts in late August 1247, when the king, quote, wrote to all the magnates of the kingdom, ordering them to assemble on the feast that is the translation of St. Edward, which is a fortnight after Michaelmas, unquote. So that would be about the 13th of October. And the king summoned them, quote, in order to hear most agreeable news of a holy benefit recently conferred by heaven on the English, unquote. That's a big thing to suddenly turn up and hear news about. When the magnates arrived that October and asked the king what the good news was, he announced to the realm that he now possessed a most sacred relic. It was a portion of the actual blood of our Lord and Saviour, Jesus Christ, authenticated as such and adorned with seals from the Patriarch of Jerusalem himself, alongside the seals of the masters of the Knights Templar and the Knights Hospitaller, alongside seals of other bishops from the Holy Land in order to authenticate it, and that this incredible relic had been sent, quote, in a most beautiful crystal container in the care of a certain well-known brother of the Templars, unquote. From the very moment a relic had arrived in England, it had apparently been kept secret, guarded, and spirited across the land to the Church of Holy Sepulchre, London, where it was left until it was needed, which was now. The king, having spent the previous night fasting, sustaining himself only on devotional prayer, early in the morning of October the 13th, 1247, he, quote, ordered all London priests to assemble at St. Paul's in good order and reverence early next morning, which was St. Edward's Day, festively dressed in hoods and surplices, with their clerks suitably attired and with cymbals, crosses, and lighted candles. The king arrived there, and receiving the container with its treasure above mentioned with the utmost honour, reverence and awe, he carried it publicly in front of his face, going on foot and wearing a humble dress, led a most solemn procession out of St. Paul's Cathedral, unquote. So there's the king, dressed as a humble pilgrim, barefoot and contrite. He left the cathedral building via the west gate, entering an area called the atrium, the courtyard with the palace of the Bishop of London to his right and the deanery buildings to the left. The king walked straight ahead towards Lungastretti. As he came out of the courtyard of the cathedral, his view would have been taken up with the streets around him. To his left and right was what we today call Creed Lane. Immediately to his left towered Montefiore Castle, the last of the Norman towers on this side of the city, and to his right the buildings around what was called Brittany Inn, and directly ahead of him was Lungastret, with the Church of St. Martin within Ludgate itself on the right-hand side of the street that ended in Ludgate. Just beyond Montefiore's were the remains of Baynard's Castle, destroyed by his father's Babacon mercenaries, while to the other side of Brittany Inn lay Eldenis Lane, which had the churches of St. Faith's on one side and the Church of the Holy Sepulchre London on the other. Still, even with this, it's probable that the king was paying no attention to the geography around him. By all accounts, dressed in his simple cloak, he carried the crystal vase containing the sacred blood of Christ in his hands, and he was supported by two attendants, and he was walking beneath a pall borne upon four spears. And during the journey ahead, it was said that the king kept his gaze fixed upon heaven above or on the holy relic he held in his royal hands. The king walked under the gate of Ludgate and crossed the ditch around the city, filled with water and lethal to any enemy. And there he entered Fleet Street. And walking along that, with the fierce-looking Fleet prison to his right, eventually he would have reached the bridge over the River Fleet, the river flowing where today stands Farringdon Street. On the other side of the bridge, he would have passed the home of the Abbot of Wincombe and the ancient church of St. Bridget's, until from his right came Shoe Lane, today's Shoe Lane, along which at this date were the gardens, orchards and vineyards of the Dominican Blackfriars, this being their first location. Travelling onwards, he would have walked along today's Fleet Street, and to his left, towards the river, he would have passed the White Friars of the Carmelites, newly arrived in the city, and next door to that, the new temple of the Order of the Knights Templar. A huge complex, easily dwarfing St. Dunstan's in the west across the street from it. The king led his procession past the gate to the temple, which sat directly opposite what was once called New Street, but around 1270 was known as Converse Lane. This was the road built by the Templars to move from the old temple in Holborn to the new temple by the river. Further up that lane stood the Dormus Conversum, the building the king had created for the care of Jews who had converted to Christianity. Beyond this and the orchard between Fleet Street and the river, following the course set by the Great Conduit, which is built along the side of the road, the king and his procession reached Temple Bar. Here the road opened up, becoming La Strandi, or the Strand, and at the Church of St. Clement Danes, the king and his attendants took the left side of the road, which would have led them to Westminster. At the Bishop of Durham's house, in what we today call Whitehall, he was met by the monks of Westminster, and by a great congregation of bishops, abbots, and other prelates. The king continued on his way south, carrying the relic down King Street. He ignored the turn to his left, the great gate that led to the outer courtyard of Westminster Palace, but carried on to what was called the North Gate of the grounds of the Abbey itself. Walking through that, passing the Abbey Bell Tower to his right and the Church of St. Margaret Westminster to his left, and following the bath through the Cemetery of St. Margaret's, which was where they buried the laity, he would have arrived at the Benedictine Abbey itself, and then started his ceremonial tour of its precincts. After leading the procession through the Abbey Church and passing the Monk Cemetery and the Postern Gate, he would have entered the inner courtyard of Westminster Palace, where the relic was toured then around the palace itself and the royal apartments, before finally returning, where he presented it to the monks and formally to their patron saints, St. Peter and St. Edward the Confessor. After this, Mass was then celebrated, and a grand sermon was delivered by the Bishop of Norwich. He extolled the virtues of this relic, specifically comparing it, in somewhat biased and flattering terms, to the relics of Christ's Passion, which had been acquired a few years earlier by the French King Louis IX. This done, the bishop proclaimed that holy indulgence would be given to all those who came to venerate the Holy Blood, and that would last for 6 years, 116 days. And after all of this, the king, now formally dressed in fine golden robes and with his crown placed upon his head, which he didn't wear often, bestowed the sacred ritual of knighthood upon his half-brother, William de Valence, and upon a number of William's associates. It was a grand and majestic pageant. Now, there were many reasons for him to hold this ceremony, and each had not just a sacred dimension, but also a political one, the two concepts working in tandem, hand in hand. This ceremony was part of Henry's increased devotions towards Westminster Abbey. Clearly, the king was hoping that this relic would attract pilgrims to the Abbey Church, which he was in the process of rebuilding. See, the problem was, ever since Edward the Confessor had received official canonization 86 years previously, neither he nor his shrine had really captured the public imagination the same way that, say, the cult of St. Thomas a Becket had brought money and pilgrims flooding into Canterbury, or even to the chapel to him on London Bridge. Now, as well as this, we know that King Henry III was an Edward the Confessor fanboy, and because of that, he had 11 years previously obtained a bull from Pope Gregory IX recommending that the feast of St. Edward became recognised as a national solemn holiday. This request was publicised at a council convened in London in November 1237, but it never stuck. The king had to send out further requests that the Confessor's feast be observed by other English churches, but the truth was, outside of Westminster, St. Edward the Confessor never really gained the public imagination as a saint to go visit and venerate. Westminster Abbey needed some additional oomph. Undaunted by reality, as was so often the case with Henry III, the king continued in his singular devotion to Westminster Abbey. It appears, when we look at the almoner's roll that survives from the year 1238, that whenever the king was in the vicinity of the abbey, he would perform special weekly rituals to the relics there. And it must be said that starting with this blood of Christ, there was an attempt to make Westminster relic central. Remember, back in 1241, he had begun rebuilding the shrine of St. Edward, and since then, the English king seems to have wanted the abbey to become a grand reliquary, akin to the newly built and much nicer Sainte-Chapelle over in Paris, which Louis IX had used to house his unrivalled collection of relics from the Passion of Christ. As such, we see from the testimony of a man called John Fleety, the prior of Westminster Abbey, he pointed out that within 10 years from this ceremony, as well as the Holy Blood of Jesus, the abbey possessed the head of St. Maurice and parts of the skull of St. Christopher, the arm of St. Sylvester, the tooth of St. Anastasius, various parts of St. Leonard, and also various parts of the clothing, blood, and the ebony comb of St. Thomas Becket. And these were alongside the tomb to St. Edward the Confessor, as well as relics from the body of St. Bartholomew and St. Thomas the Apostle. And 2 years from now, the king would give the monks in the abbey a stone bearing the imprint of Christ's very own footstep, brought to the Holy Land by a group of Dominican friars, along with a single spine from the crown of thorns and some other holy blood presumably shed at the Passion. So, for the first part, this is clearly an attempt to make Westminster the one-stop pilgrimage shop location for the lucrative trade in pilgrims, a business we know St. Paul's had long been playing. So that was the first reason why he was doing this. But on top of this, there was something else happening. The rituals, the ceremonies, and the sending of the relic of the Holy Blood was seen as part of ongoing diplomacy with the Crusader states of Outre-Mer, which culminated in the fact that 3 years after this, Henry III was to take the Crusader vow. Now, he had informally taken it as a child, but he was a child then. But in 1250, Henry III is going to take the cross. And this whole ritual seemed to be part of it. I covered a couple of chapters ago, between 1228 and 1244, the city of Jerusalem had been briefly back under Christian lordship. But in 1244, it had fallen once again to a seemingly invincible alliance of the Khwarizmian Turks and As-Salid Ayyub, the Sultan of Egypt and Damascus. The Christian Patriarch of Jerusalem at the time was a man from Breton called Cobert of Nantes, and he ended up being stuck in Acre in exile, living on the coast. Now, over the next few years, it was he more than anyone else who was responsible for bombarding England and the rest of Christian Europe with requests for assistance in launching a new crusade. The papacy, however, were not overtly keen in Henry actually going. Given that Louis IX had taken the cross immediately after the fall of Jerusalem in 1244, it appeared to be that Pope Innocent IV was anxious that King Henry remain behind in Europe to counter any attempt by the Holy Roman Emperor Frederick II to exploit King Louis's absence in the East. And to be blunt, after 1244, the chief thrust of papal diplomacy seems to have been directed more towards securing peace between England and France, especially over affairs in Gascony, than towards any attempt to recruit Henry as an actual crusader in his own right. Nevertheless, by 1247, when this holy blood turns up, many Englishmen had taken the cross, the most prominent being the king's cousin and veteran crusader, William the Earl of Salisbury, as well as the Bishop of Worcester. So the sending of this relic was designed to drum up interest, cash, and recruits for an upcoming crusade. As a result, basically in the years leading up to and just after the arrival of this relic, a large number of papal and Eastern-based envoys were dispatched to England to preach the cross, to collect papal taxation and arrears of early and crusading taxes, and to secure the monetary redemption of vows for crusaders unable or unsuited to actually make the journey to the East. The 6 months leading up to October 1247 had witnessed missions to England by a series of papal agents whose demands for clerical subsidy had been conceded by the crown. There'd also been a visit to the court by the Emperor of Constantinople himself, Baldwin II, who in May 1247 had received cash subsidies of 1,000 marks of silver and the cost of his journey home. In addition to all of this, the bishop-elect of the See of Bethlehem, a man called Goffredo de Prifetti, had spent several weeks in England in May and June of 1247, issuing indulgences at least 3 English monasteries. And the visit by the Bishop of Bethlehem was to have a huge, many centuries impact upon London, but I'll come back to that at the end. Basically, as well as being used to try and drum up pilgrim business to Westminster, the blood relic was being used to try and drum up interest in the forthcoming crusade. The idea of sending the holy blood of Jesus itself was clearly intended as a means of focusing people's minds upon the suffering of Christ, which then helps the case for joining a crusade to liberate the lands where Jesus suffered in. In the next few years, the blood relic was used as the focus of preparations for the crusade to come. And by 1250, while the king was getting ready to take the vow of the crusader, the relic appears to have been rehoused in a splendid new reliquary and was in Westminster where he took that vow. Of course, the king didn't go on crusade, but 2 years after that, in 1252, Henry summoned the men of London to Westminster to hear and repeat his vows and listen to sermons preached by the bishops of Worcester and Chichester and the abbot of Westminster. And that abbot of Westminster, alongside the aforesaid Bishop of Norwich, who I mentioned earlier, became the main English commissioners of the crusades of the 1250s. So this whole ritual had a massive diplomatic element. But it's worth considering that the sacred ritual of the arrival of the Holy Blood of Christ also had a domestic political element to it, several in fact. The procession was ended with a much more down-to-earth ritual, as I described. After the king finished his whole walking barefoot carrying the blood of Christ part, he then put on his finest clothes and summoned his leading nobles to attend him in Westminster, gathering the great men of the kingdom to witness the knighting of Henry's half-brother, William de Valence. This guy was to be important. William de Valence and his three brothers, Aymar, Guy and Geoffrey de Lusignan, were the children of Henry III's mother, Isabel of Angoulême. And after his father, King John, had died, she'd married a noble from Poitevin called Hugh de Lusignan, the Count of La Marche. William, Guy and Aymar had all come to England early in the summer of 1247 and had immediately been showered with favours. That August, William had been married to the heiress of a portion of the great earldom of Pembroke. William's sister, Alice, was betrothed to a young Earl Warrenne here in England. These guys were clearly the new king's favourite. Now, the records of the Royal Chancery and Exchequer are entirely silent about the king's gift of the Holy Blood to Westminster, but they contain a hell of a lot of information about the expenses spent during the party to celebrate William de Valence being knighted by his half-brother, the king. William de Valence received 30 silver dishes and a dozen silver cups, each engraved with his coat of arms. And the party spared no expense with its provision for wine and candles at the great feast to celebrate the knighting of William and the seven other men, most of them who were English, who were knighted at the same time as him. This was a big ceremony. And crucially, Henry III decided to combine it on the same day as the ritual of the arrival of the Holy Blood of Christ. And he's sending out a clear signal. This knighting, this ceremony, this was special. But the thing is, from the very moment they arrived in England, William de Valence and his brothers had faced huge amounts of suspicion from many of the English nobles, and not just the English-based nobles. The Lusignan brothers gained hostility from the king's Savoyard uncles, who for the past decade or so had enriched themselves from the stock of royal patronage due to their sister marrying the king. There were a couple of reasons why these brothers ran into such hostility. One, they were the sons of the aforesaid Hugh, Count of La Marche, and he was seen as the most fickle and double-dealing of all the nobles in this part of Europe. Indeed, it's fair to say that since the reign of the king's father, Count Hugh had blighted and thwarted every attempt by the Plantagenets to reclaim Normandy. And being his sons, the boys were tainted with the same brush of suspicion. As recently as 1242, only 5 years before now, Hugh had conspired with the French to bring about the collapse of Henry III's latest expedition. And that was one of the great diplomatic and financial debacles of Henry's reign, and which had dealt a serious blow to the royal finances. For the next 15 years, Henry III was to lurch from one financial crisis to another, drawing upon a dwindling supply of money, lands and heiresses from which to purchase support. So nobody trusted them because of their father's action, but also patronage from the crown was now in increasingly short supply. So not only did many think the Lusignan's arrival was allowing a fox into the chicken coop, added to that, these lavish gifts bestowed by the king upon his half-brothers could only be made at the expense of other men already established at the court. And it is fair to say that the English nobility really did resent the arrival of the Lusignans. And you see proof of this soon after, because we see a lovely way that these knights and barons of England were able to show exactly what they thought of William de Valence. See, we have an account that says on March the 4th the next year, quote, "A grand tournament amongst the knights of England, strenuously to test their military skill, was held at Newbury. William of Valence, half-brother of the king, a novice intent on acquiring knightly renown, took part there, advancing with audacious spirit, but his tender age and imperfect strength not allowing him to resist the impetus of hardened and warlike knights, he was prostrated, and as an initiation to knighthood, thoroughly beaten," unquote. Yeah, welcome to England, you little French shit. So why was the king supporting William of Valence and his brothers? Well, it's clear that Henry III saw the Lusignans as his beloved kinsmen who will provide him to a vital link to Poitou, And by bringing them under his wing, their dynasty would be on his side now. And that long dream of reconquest of the Plantagenet lands of France could begin without Count Hugh working against him. You want proof this is what he was thinking? Well, when the brothers arrived in 1247, it coincided with a mission to France by the king's brother, Richard, Earl of Cornwall, during which Louis IX was once again petitioned for the restoration of Normandy to Henry. Louis is said to have referred the matter to the Norman bishops, who inevitably pronounced against the Plantagenet claim. Nonetheless, Henry still treasured dreams of a Plantagenet Reconquista in which his Lusignan half-brothers would have an important role to play. What better way of reconciling the Lusignans to a suspicious court than by combining the knighthood ceremony of William de Valence with the splendid sacred welcome of the Holy Blood? So, as you can see, this ceremony was doing three things at the same time. Boosting the prestige of Westminster Abbey by supplying the monks with a relic fit enough to rival those of the Sainte-Chapelle in Paris. Focusing the minds of others upon the passions of Christ and hence the recent sufferings of the Holy Land. And providing an elaborate cover to welcome a new and already controversial powerful faction into the English court. It was a grand plan. Unfortunately, it completely failed on all three counts. Westminster never became a London Sainte-Chapelle. The Crusade never liberated Jerusalem, and the Lusignans were to remain disliked and hated by many for years to come. In fact, what should have been a grand and brilliant triumph and pivotal moment in the reign of Henry III is at most a mere footnote in history, really. London would have seen this big deal, but as the years passed, it became an also moment. It would be easy to think that while this was going on, local politics wasn't happening. But it was, because in 1247, two controversial names appear in the records of London politics again. Nicholas Batt, the king's favourite mayor and former sheriff, was reappointed as Sheriff of London this year. And in response, Michael Tovey, the man who the king detested, is made mayor again. I mean, the last time he was mayor, the king had actually refused to recognise him. So what was going to happen now? Well, it looks like Michael Tovey, Mayor of London, was someone who was a complete lightning rod for all things to do with conflict with the king. 1247 had seen an ongoing legal case which had caused the division between the crown-appointed justiciar of the city and, as I've covered previously, the local London authorities. There's an ongoing debate between the crown and the city about who should be in charge of London legal cases. 1247, just before this ritual with the Holy Blood of Christ happens, there had been an especially strong row, where the justiciar had ruled that in a significant legal case, which I'm not going to get into, but basically he said the city had organised everything wrong. And as always, especially when Michael Tovey was mayor, there was conflict. And eventually, quote, at length, after much altercation had taken place between the justiciar and the citizens, the justiciar said that they must show all this to the king and his council. And so they withdrew. Afterwards, however, and solely for this cause, his lordship the king took the city into his hand, and by his writ entrusted it to the custody of William de Haverhill and Edward de Westminster, unquote. So once again, the king refused to accept Michael Tovey as mayor of London, and is using this legal falling out as an excuse to suspend the city's liberties again on August 24th. London's feeling a tad hard done by, and the records say, quote, whereupon the mayor and the citizens went to the king at Woodstock and showed him that they'd done no wrong, but they could not regain his favour, unquote. It was clear Henry III still had an axe to grind about Michael Tovey, and these two crown appointees took over the running of the city, quote, wherefore, upon their arrival in London, the aforesaid William de Haverhill extracted an oath of the clerks and all the sergeants who belonged to the chevalerity, that they would be obedient unto him, the mayor and sheriffs being removed from their bailiwicks, unquote. Now, it must be said that at the time all this was going on, according to the historian Matthew Paris, who was writing at the time, The king was actually annoyed at London because of another entirely separate pressing issue. You see, he was broke. As we'd mentioned, he was seriously broke. It's said at a meeting of the royal court, while all this was going on, or just before this was going on, the king, quote, lost his temper and said to his councillors, "It's your fault that the magnates have been alienated from me. Look, I'm at the point of losing Gascony and have been robbed of Poitou. My treasury is empty. What can I do?" A weak-minded council was held, and it was decided that the vessels, utensils, and jewels of the royal treasury should be sold by weight, so that at all events, money could be raised, unquote. Yeah, the King of England was so broke, he initiated a fire sale and sold his goods, and actually did make some money. Quote, "The royal councillors added a shameful consolation to soothe the king, insinuating to him that just as all the rivers flow into the sea, so all the things now sold will certainly return to you at some time in the form of gifts. Therefore, our lord king has no need to worry." After the sale, the king inquired where and to whom the plate had been sold. And when he was told London, he said, I know, if Octavianus's treasure was for sale, the city of London would buy up the whole lot. For these coarse Londoners, who call themselves barons, are rolling in money. That city is an inexhaustible well. And he immediately conceived the idea, as soon as the occasion arose, of plundering the citizens for their goods, unquote. So yeah, to Henry III, these coarse Londoners were rolling in money. And so the fallout over Michael Tovey being mayor was really just an excuse for him to get money. And we read that on September the 8th of that year, quote, "The mayor and the sheriffs, by leave of the king, received the city into their hands," unquote. We can assume that he basically charged them a fortune to get the city back. And yet it is clear, while all this is going on and he's ripping him off for a load of money, he genuinely did have a very sharp axe he wished to grind against London. And what followed was indicative of Henry III responding to London and her citizens at all times with hostility. So the entry in the Liber de Antiqua says of the next year, 1248, quote, "In this year, the citizens of London, at the request of his lordship the king, not compelled and yet as though compelled, took their wares to the fair at Westminster on St. Edward's Day, and also the citizens of many cities of England, by precept of his lordship the king, repaired thither with their wares, all of whom made a stay at that fair of full 15 days, all the shops and sells of the merchants of London in the meantime being closed," unquote. So it transpired that a few years earlier, there may or may not have been fairs at Westminster, possibly going back to much earlier times. But the monks of Westminster had gained permission to now hold two annual fairs on the grounds of the Abbey, one in January and one in October. And by doing so, they could use the ground rents of stallholders to help pay for the reconstruction of the Abbey. However, the king now saw another opportunity to punish London. And so the year after he did the blood ritual, he ordered that the October fair was to be extended. It was to last for 2 weeks, a full 15 days. And crucially, as that quote said, all the shops in London and all the market stalls in London and any goods whatsoever in London could no longer be sold within the city during those 15 days. If any Londoner wanted to do any business, they'd have to go downriver to Westminster. But to give him his due, he wasn't just being strict on London, because Matthew Paris recorded, quote, "The Lord King ordered it to be officially announced and proclaimed throughout the whole city of London and elsewhere by public crier that he had initiated a new fair to be held at Westminster to continue for a full fortnight. And in order that the Westminster fair should be more cumbrously abound with people and merchandise, he absolutely forbade, on penalty of weighty forfeiture and fines, all markets usually held in England for such a period of time. For instance, the fairs at Ely and elsewhere, as well as all trade carried out in London, both in and out of doors, unquote. So, to be fair, the king was banning any rival fair going on everywhere, but on top of that, he was also banning all trade in London. London was clearly feeling it the worst. And yet, the fair was held in Westminster that following October, a year on after the ceremony of the Holy Blood, and, quote, as a result, a vast crowd of people flocked there, as if to the most famous fair, and so the translation of the Blessed Edward and the Blood of Christ was amazingly venerated by the people assembled there, unquote. Oh, look, so by doing this, not only did they generate a whole bunch of trade and a whole bunch of taxes, it also meant that the Blood of Christ and the tomb of St. Edward the Confessor got a whole load of pilgrims. That's a total win for the king, right? Well, not quite, I'm afraid, because the king forgotten the time of year the feast day of St. Edward the Confessor took place, October, and that meant there was a massive caveat to all of this. And to quote Matthew Paris, as he describes it in wonderfully colourful detail, quote, but all those who exhibited their goods for sale there suffered great inconvenience because of the lack of roofs apart from canvas awnings, for the variable gusts of wind usual at that time of year battered the merchants so that they were cold, wet, hungry and thirsty, their feet were dirtied by the mud, and their merchandise spoilt by rain. When they sat down there at table, those who normally took their meals at home by the family fireside could not stand this discomfort. The Bishop of Ely, because of the loss of his fair at Ely, which the royal edict had suspended, made a very serious complaint about this to the king for introducing such novelties to the detriment of his subjects. But he gained nothing except empty words and comforting promises of future consolation, unquote. Yep, so a miserable time was had by all, and the Londoners would have felt slightly vindicated and maybe found some support in their complaints about this bloody fair at Westminster. That meant for 2 weeks, nobody could buy or sell anything in the city. Indeed, if you look at all the moments associated with the arrival of the relic of the Blood of Christ to Westminster, only one made a truly long-lasting impact upon the city. Earlier in the account, I did mention a bunch of visitors turning up from the Middle East and the whole foreign policy aspect of it all. And arguably, the most important of these visitors was the bishop-elect of Bethlehem, Goffredo de Perfetti. Now, he was a Roman who for many years had been beneficed in England. In other words, he got cash from here. In October 1247, Goffredo attended the delivery of the Holy Blood to Westminster, and then he went around issuing indulgences for at least three other English monasteries. He was the bishop of the exiled See of Bethlehem, after all. That made him a big deal. Which probably explains why, on October 23rd, 1247, less than a fortnight after the delivery of the relic of the Holy Blood to Westminster, Goffredo was given a grant of land in London outside Bishopsgate, roughly where today stands modern-day Liverpool Street train station. Now, this was given to him by the then Sheriff of London, a man called Simon Fitzmary, and it was decided that this would be the location of a new priory, a place where visitors from the Holy Land and those with business with them could stay, a place of crusaders and exiles. It was a priory, and it was to be called St. Mary's Priory, Bethlehem, or St. Mary's Bethlehem. Now, as I said, according to some sources, Goffredo established his priory on land possibly given by Simon Fitzmary, and it was first intended to serve as the lodgings for the bishop and canons of Bethlehem whenever they visited England. But by 1329, we know that this place was looking after the sick, and those who kept the place and the sick it cared for were following the rule of the Church of Bethlehem and therefore were wearing the sign of a star on their caps and their cloaks. The Bethlehem Hospital of St. Mary's was to provide a tangible link between the English and the Crusader states, and this Crusader church in exile lasted for centuries hereafter. Only its real claim to fame lies in the fact that in the years to come, two things about this priory would change. The first is that it would no longer be a lodging for the exiled bishops of Bethlehem, and would, by 1403, become a place that specialised in caring for those suffering from maladies of the mind, where they could come find respite and care. And its reputation as a place the insane of London could find shelter grew. The second thing that changed was its name. The Hospital of St. Mary's Bethlehem, or Bethlehem's Hospital, is a bit of a mouthful. In London's parlance, this place by Bishopgate gained a new name for itself. Bedlam. This is the origins of Bedlam. And for reasons entirely based on hindsight, this seems like a perfect place to end. Thanks for listening. Hope you enjoyed it. We're back again next week for another chapter in the story of London. Cheers.